The capital of the disintegrating Habsburgian multinational empire, Vienna around 1900, represents, all at the same time, a locus of the apocalypse, as well as a cradle of epochal movements and achievements of the modern age, characterized and defined by contradictions and polarities. The wealth of the center stands in stark contrast to the misery in the suburbs. The identity crisis of the elite and the urban social order collides with the new collective subjects of a looming mass politics. The skeptical reality discourse of the bourgeois late Enlightenment forms a peculiar antipode to a politics of emotion which finds its expression in nationalism and anti-Semitism. The aesthetics of a highly articulate noble culture are countered by a culture of the masses stigmatized as profane and raw. This Vienna of the fin de siècle, as Robert Musil would establish in his magnificent The Man Without Qualities, resembled a boiling bubble of chartered and unchartered paths, a great rhythmic beat and the eternal out-of-tuneness and transposition of all rhythms against one another. The imperial seat of the downright supra-personal Habsburg Emperor Franz Josef I was home to Sigmund Freud, Gustav Mahler, Oskar Kokoschka, Arthur Schnitzler, Leon Trotsky, and Adolf Hitler at one and the same time. For a brief two-month period in 1913, the latter could have, and only here, run into Stalin, who was residing in Vienna to study the coexistence of nationalities on behalf of his party. It was the city of Mayor Patriarch Karl Lueger who molded anti-Semitism into a political mass movement, and the city of Jewish doctor and social reformer Viktor Adler, mastermind of a dawning democratic socialism. It was the city of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern Zionism, and the city of Nobel Peace Prize winner Bertha von Suttner, as well as that of pedagogue and women's rights pioneer Eugenie Schwarzwald. Indeed, a headstrong conglomerate of the most diverse, contradictory, yet also complementary social, political, and cultural developments. In the Hofburg Palace, in the heart of Vienna, the old emperor grappled to maintain autocracy and the myth of his glorious empire. Even though the political power of aristocracy was long past its peak, its cultural legacy prevailed in the fantasy and imagination of a middle class striving for definite recognition and social ennoblement. In the inner suburbs, a petit bourgeois and bureaucracy apparatus impartial to the modern age grumbled about the loss of old Vienna as the epitome of Biedermeier tranquility and simplicity. In the outer industrial suburbs, which surrounded the city like an iron belt of workers' quarters, converged squalid housing conditions, social destitution, mass immigration, and potential insurgency. On the magnificent Ringstrasse Boulevard, however, a bourgeois population with economic clout celebrated the success of a belated capitalism in the form of pompous architecture and art patronage. Prologue. In the evening hours of March 13th of the momentous year 1848, they came, uninhibited, wild, indignant, fearsome, terrifying, violent. They came to rise up against their all-embracing misery, against their unspeakable working conditions, against their precarious, slave-like everyday existence. In the first half of the 19th century, essentially right in the lap of the late feudal social order, the specter of communism decreed by Marx and Engels in the Manifesto began to take shape in this part of the world as a rapidly growing factory proletariat, primarily in the proto-industrial enclaves of Bohemia, the Vienna Basin, and above all, in Vienna's suburbs. Substantially compromised of underage children, without rights to organization, and without any social perspective, this emerging factory proletariat was subject to to the dictate of a new rigorous work discipline, as well as the experience of recurring phases of unemployment and the unavoidable associated impoverishment. The consequences, writes the Imperial Council delegate and revolutionary democrat Ernst von Violon, were evident, at least in Vienna, in the boundless immorality and ethical negligence. Complete suburbs such as Lichtental, Lerchenfeld, Strotzscher Grund, Margareten, Fünfen, Sechshaus were veritably overcrowded with famished, ragged workers. In the evenings, the unfortunate girls from the factories offered their service to anyone for a halfpenny on the glacis and along the city's moats. The housing crisis took on unimagined dimensions. A population increase of approximately 40% since 1830 stood opposite a mere 10% expansion of the housing stock. On the peripheries of the suburbs, there agglomerated an early industrial lower class of day and casual laborers in slum-like emergency shelters. Every night, the police would transport thousands of homeless outside the line, today the Gürtelring Road, to the open fields. In frenzied riots, this factory labor force now began to rebel against their unrestricted exploitation. From 1843 to 1846, revolts cropped up in Brno, Prague, Liberec, and other Bohemian cities. In 1847, they spilled over to Vienna. Against the backdrop of a catastrophically bad harvest, massive bread riots broke out in the Fünf and Sechshaus suburbs. On March 13, 1848, on the occasion of a meeting of the Lower Austrian estates, when students and citizens formulated their demands for a constitution and civil liberties, the Viennese suburbs erupted in a storm of revolt and machine breaking. Without internal organization, but as if upon a secret signal, workers left their workshops. Armed with clubs, batons, stones, and iron instruments, the rebelling mass marched down Mariahilferstraße like a procession in the direction of the inner city. 100-strong gang managed to surmount the bastions. They would play a decisive and dynamic role in the insurrection of the inner city and the attack on the headquarters of the Court Council of War. Their rage on this day, writes Violon, was horrifying. Life seemed worthless to them. And while a part of the suburban proletarian crowd rambled and stalked around the city walls, howling like starving wolves, the gas pipelines on the glacis and the candelabra in front of the Burgtor city gate were ripped open and the stream of gas ignited. A horrendous wall of fire around Vienna thus marked the end of the rule of the despot Metternich. The unbelievable and the unimaginable, something that burst all conventions, had become reality. Revolting subjects had entrapped and besieged the emperor and his imperial court in their very own residence. The sovereign ruler of three decades, the chancellor, was now on the run. And even though the uprising could be repressed in the most brutal way a half year later by the mercenaries of Windischgrätz and the Croatian Banuš Jelačić, it was paramount to prevent any such thing from happening in the future and with all means necessary. Last but not least, through the strategic redesign of urban space. A magnificent urban boulevard. That Vienna possessed a vast piece of open property around its old center, which was available for modern developments, was ironically a result of the city's historical backwardness. The bastions, curtain walls, and glacis, the defensive fortification system around the inner city, had remained intact even after they had lost their military functions and other European cities had long since torn down their walls. The Revolution of 1848 had refreshed the political and strategic significance of the Glacis' open fields, albeit not against a potential foreign aggressor, rather a potential revolutionary urban population. The Central Military Council's main argument opposing a civil development of the Glacis was the persistence of a revolutionary threat and the protection of the imperial court against possible attacks by the suburban proletariat. The dynamic of foreseeable economic developments and the intrinsic social requirements, however, increasingly left such lines of argumentation in the background. This is how the Ringstrasse project unified military deliberations with the need of a prospering, politically influential middle class for a monumental, representative boulevard. Without doubt, the Ring, with its splendid political and cultural landmarks and palatial luxury apartment houses, with its eclectic historicist prestige architecture, is quite an extraordinary feat of urban planning and design, an urban Gesamtkunstwerk. If nothing else, it is the built expression of a triumph of liberalism, the material and symbolic representation of the now dominant economic model of financial capitalism, regardless how belated and ambivalently it manifested. And yet, each and every Ringstrasse building, with the exception of the Votivchurch intended for the imperial cult, in its design, site, and contextualization is de facto a concrete projection of a competition between highly diversified claims to power and cultural ambitions. The construction of an enclosed inner city boulevard transpired in the spirit of neo-absolutism, which intended to connect its project of authoritarian and repressive top-down modernization with a symbolic reinforcement of state power. The political should be flanked with cultural centralization, with Vienna becoming the center of an Austrian supranational modern conservative mindset. The notorious imperial decree from the end of 1857, which inaugurated the redesign of the capital and the development of the Glacis, was formulated very much along these lines. Still, along with their rise in the state and the city, the more liberal powers in the remarkably heterogeneous Urban Development Commission began to get their way the stronger the support was from institutions that embodied the liberal values of civil law and the culture of rationality. Parliament, City Hall, the University. Across from the Hofburg extension by architects Semper and Hasenauer, the City Hall district, under the massive influence and participation of the liberal municipal administration, was designed on the parade grounds, the last remaining plot in military ownership, as a citizens' forum, so to speak, a triumph of historical eclecticism and the most eloquent spatial expression of civil power. Heinrich Ferstel designed the university in Renaissance style, which had established a culture of secular rationalism for the first time. For his design of the parliament, Theophil Hansen fell back on the formal language of classical antiquity so admired by the liberals. And the liberal mayor Cajetan Felder accomplished a deft masterpiece with his commission for City Hall to Friedrich Schmidt. Schmidt was not only highly reputed among liberals for his secular Gothic architecture, he also enjoyed the protection of ultra-conservative Cardinal Josef Rauscher, for whom he had realized numerous projects. Also in the case of Semper's Baroque Burgtheater, for example, the selected style, the ambiguous vocabulary of his Torsist architecture, drew an associative connection with the function of the respective building. In this manner, rivaling pretensions, opposing interests, and historical compromises are inscribed into the architectural and spatial design of the Ringstrasse quarters. Albeit, they all had one function in common. What was once a ring of military segregation had now transformed into a ring of social division. The Ringstrasse, as a self-contained figure, delineated society at the same time. The urban fabric was, in many ways, a reflection of social fault lines. Nevertheless, in distinct contrast to other European metropoles, the aesthetic standards of the Ringstrasse facades, which even specified the outer design of apartment blocks in the worker suburbs, unified it into a contradictory whole. Outlook. Up above, however, in the sophisticated roof constructions, pediments and veranda-like protrusions on the venerable Ringstrasse palaces, close to the heavens and typically hard to make out for mere mortals, if at all, thrones the world of the gods. For 1.5 centuries now, it has been the silent eyewitness to epic manifestations and infamous mass rallies by those down there, witness to human perfidies hard to put in words, and uplifting visionary expressions of historical power alike. It saw the voting right and May Day rallies of a proletariat demonstrating itself and its great numbers, the last breaths of a broken Habsburg emperor along with his empire, the so-called Ständestaat homages in front of a dwarfish, authoritarian Austro-fascist chancellor. It was witness to bestial police violence on the occasion of the Palace of Justice fire on July 15, 1927, and the suggestive mass hysteria when Hitler called ethnic Germans back home to the Reich. It saw the destruction of the Burgtheater and the opera during the war, and more recently, the major peace demonstrations or the hundreds of thousands strong outrage against the formation of a civil government coalition with right-wing populism. At each and every time, in a symbolic and factual concentration, this magnificent urban boulevard has signaled, like a seismograph, the fate and fortune of the city and its people with unerring precision. May its gods be with us.